you know that we love our on-demand listeners, and that's why we've produced this Issues Etc. Classic. Now, if you appreciate this special broadcast, please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. You can donate by check, make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio, and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us at the end of 2010.
Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. The Christmas story is familiar, isn't it? And you can drive down any street, any Midwest town, and see occasionally the nativity scene, and that pretty much says it all, doesn't it? Jesus lying there in a manger as a baby, Mary and Joseph, a few shepherds, camel or two, maybe a donkey and a cow, little drummer boy, maybe if you want to add a little bit, and then the three kings off there in the corner on their way into the scene. How much do we know about this event that stands at the very beginning of the gospel story as revealed to us in the New Testament? The very beginning of Christ's incarnation and birth. How much do we know, not only from Scripture, but also from secular sources? We're going to talk about that the first Christmas in this hour of Issues Etc. My guest, Dr. Paul Meyer. Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He's author of several books, including a new edition of his 1991 book titled The First Christmas. Dr. Meyer, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello, Todd. Good to be back with you.
Is there any more information available than that which we find in the Bible with regard to Christ's birth?
Well, my hobby the last 25 or 30 years has been to try to beat the bushes of the ancient world to come up with some fresh data from the sidelines. I use the lateral approach into the biblical account to see what we can find from history, archaeology, geographical, climatological, meteorological, even astronomical evidence in regard to the Star of Bethlehem, of course. And there's a way, I think, of not trying to gild the lily, but by checking the secular sources, we find that not only is the most familiar story about the greatest life ever lived historical, but it is beautiful in the extreme, and we can also add fresh material to it.
Why use both sacred and secular evidence? What's the point there?
Well, I think if we do that, we have three or four advantages. First of all, we have a way of checking up on the reliability of the biblical record. There are so many people out there who think that the only way we can ever get to these people and places and events that gave rise to Christianity is through the sacred covers of the Bible. And they think it's only in the Bible. There's no other way to check up on it. And that's wrong. We're really stunning to see how many events that are mentioned inside the Bible are cited also in secular sources. So I've had a lot of fun playing those sources in to test the biblical record out. And then we can actually add material to the biblical record. I don't think it's wrong to say that it's not really embellishing and it's not gilding the lily, but sometimes the evidence is quite powerful, that it corroborates the account and adds to it. And then we also can clear up some of the difficulties in the biblical record by doing this. And finally, also, we can fill in important gaps. So that's why I love to play around with the secular sources.
Now, you say in this new edition of your book, The First Christmas, that you're not interested in cardboard cutouts or plaster saints or heroes of antiquity. You're writing about real people. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think very often when we refer to something like the Christmas story, it's, of course, a traditional term, a Christmas story. Now, what does story connote? It often means fairy tale. It often means something that happened in Middle Earth or Never Never Land or someplace like that. A neat tale that isn't necessarily true at all, that may, in fact, be totally myth. And I'd like to point out that the Christmas story is Christmas history. There's a difference there. This really happened.
Okay. Let's begin by setting the context and finding out everything we can in the short amount of time allotted to us about this Christmas story. Let's start with the way Luke begins his story. He kind of gives us a political overview. Who's the emperor? Augustus. What time is it? It's a time of a census, and the whole world is going to be registered so they can be accurately taxed. What do we know about this political environment into which Christ was born?
Well, right there, I think we have an indication that Luke would be congenial to this particular approach because he uses it himself. There's simply no question about it. Luke also begins by the lateral or secular approach to the very sacred story. Begins with somebody that you have never seen pictured on any Christmas card. A rather un-Christmassy figure, as a matter of fact, Caesar Augustus. I don't think you've ever received a Christmas card with the bust of Augustus on, have you?
No, I have not.
All right, well, I haven't either. But it's Luke's way of pointing out that what we have here is fact and not fiction, because everybody knew about the great Augustus. Everybody knew about the censuses that he took. As a matter of fact, Augustus was so proud of his censuses that when he died, he previously had decided that his 38 greatest accomplishments should be recorded on two great brass tablets that were placed in front of his mausoleum. And point number eight, I took a census of the empire three times. He's very excited about that. And so it's something that Luke will use not only to point out the historicity of this episode, but also to engage the interest of his hearers. Everybody knew, again, about this first and greatest Roman emperor, and so they would easily salute at that point.
Okay, why was the census taken? What does history tell us?
Well, basically, everybody likes to know how many citizens there are, you know, or people in the empire. And then, of course, this was the basis for taxation as well. As a matter of fact, the old King James Version simply says everyone went to be taxed. It's not quite what the Greek says, but that's the whole purpose of it. And the fact that the Romans took these censuses from time to time has been proved again and again and again, because we actually have census documents from the Roman Empire period, especially in neighboring Egypt, where some of these papyri have stood the test of time. Every Christmas, University of Michigan in Ann Arbor brings out one of these scraps of, we're not talking copy here or recopy, we're talking an original papyrus census document, which lists the things that Joseph would have had to say down in Bethlehem, identifying himself. It's just fascinating to see how very, very historical all this is. And another census was discovered, again from neighboring Egypt, which requested everybody to go back to their ancestral home villages to register. So nobody's kidding here about Joseph going down to Bethlehem.
Does this also help us, since we can corroborate the time of this census during the reign of Augustus, does this help us arrive at a more accurate date for the birth of Christ?
This one doesn't, simply because the Romans didn't have, or at least we don't know of any exact time schedule that they had for taking these censuses. And some of them were pretty hairy. I mean, they took a long time to collect all the data. For example, when Caesar conquered Gaul, they didn't really get a decent census from Gaul, which is today France, of course, for 40 years. You know, talk about many years of poll taking there. So this census in Judea, you know, could have taken some time, and it's not very helpful in trying to fix the time of the first Christmas. We have other clues from the Gospels that enable us to zero in a little bit more easily.
Is it safe to say that if someone says, well, Jesus was born year zero or year one B.C. or something like that, A.D., that they're a few years off?
Yes, there's no question that Jesus could not have been born before April of 4 B.C. Why do I say that? Because the chronology involving Herod the Great, a member who killed the babies in Bethlehem, that's pretty definite. And Herod died about April 1st of 4 B.C. And if he's going to have a role at all in the nativity account, Jesus had to have been born before then. So Jesus was born, we think, probably the second part of the year 5 B.C., 5 years before himself, of course. Please don't blame him for bad timing. It was a case of a calendar switch made around 525 A.D. It's incredible to realize that when the Roman Empire went Christian after Constantine, they were still using the old Roman calendar, basing it on the founding of Rome, AUC, Ab Urbe Condita, from the founding of the city. And finally, it was Bishop John of Rome who said, this is ridiculous. We keep naming it after a pagan situation here. Why don't we name it after the birth of Jesus? And so they found the fellow who knew his numbers best, a little monk from Scythia, whose name was Dionysius Exiguus, Dennis the Little, and he was good with numbers. Today he'd be a computer nerd, probably. And he redid the calendar, our BC-AD calendar, and he screwed up by about 5 years. Fact is, we're surprised he got that close.
It is really amazing, considering that he had very little to go on.
Yeah, the records in those days, really, right.
Okay, before we go to this break, what do we know about Mary and Joseph?
Well, we know, first of all, they're both up in Galilee. They're both up in Nazareth. We're getting a better and better guess as to why Joseph was up there in the first place. You know, here's a citizen of Bethlehem. What in the world is he doing in the North Country? Well, I think the answer may come from a fascinating archaeological dig taking place just 3 or 4 miles northwest of Nazareth today. This is the famous site of the ancient city of Sepphoris. Some people pronounce it Sepphoris, which was destroyed at the time of the census because they wouldn't participate by the Romans, and it was being rebuilt by Herod Antipas. That's the son of Herod the Great. Remember, he has a role in executing John the Baptist and even a role in Good Friday. The same Herod was rebuilding that city to his capital for Galilee. Josephus calls it the jewel of all of Galilee. And to rebuild a city in 12 years' time, you would have to have craftsmen available who could do the job. And so there was a lot of the talents demanded by that project. And it was probably a good guess that Joseph came up from Bethlehem to Nazareth to assist in the rebuilding of Sepphoris. Joseph is called a tecton in the New Testament. It means carpenter, but that means also anybody in the construction trades.
Well, let's take a break there. That's an interesting thing, because we usually call him a carpenter. He used the word craftsman. That might be a better term for Joseph, the stepfather of Jesus.
Folks, the gospel is free, but producing this show isn't. Please consider making a year-end, tax-deductible donation to Issues Etc. today.
Dr. Meyer, before we went to the break, you were telling us that maybe the term carpenter is too narrow a term for Joseph.
Yes, I think he probably had wider talents than that. You don't have that much wood in the Holy Land. You have a lot of stone for building purposes. And so, really, the term tecton in Greek can mean anybody in the construction trades, including a stone cutter or mason, bricklayer, and that sort of person.
Okay, what do we know about his mother, Mary?
Mary, an early church tradition says, was born in Sepphoris, this very interesting archaeological dig that I'm talking about, or that was talking about. Her traditional names for her parents are Joachim, the father, and Anna. We're not quite sure about that, but that does come from one of the earliest gospels that didn't really make the canon. So there may be some historicity there, but the fact that she could have come from Sepphoris is certainly very logical. She, again, was a Galilean, not a Judean, as Joseph was.
What kind of a town was Nazareth?
Nazareth was a little speck on the map, not very significant at all. As a matter of fact, some critics used to doubt that Nazareth ever existed, and they were then attacking the New Testament on that basis. That has now been proven fallacious, because a list of synagogues has been discovered at Caesarea in which the name Nazareth is included. So we know there definitely was a synagogue there in the town there by that name. But it doesn't show up in the Old Testament and doesn't even show up in the Talmud.
Now, the account in Matthew, the first chapter, says that Mary and Joseph were engaged to one another. What kind of arrangement would that have been?
Well, engagement in those days was far more serious than engagement today, which, you know, can be broken and so on. In those days, engagement was very nearly tantamount to marriage. If the betrothed husband, for example, died, the widow was really a widow and not just a betrothed person who would then receive the inheritance. And you wouldn't break an engagement except by the same rules that were used to divorce, to break up a marriage. So it's very serious indeed.
And what would the marriage have... I mean, after this period of engagement, we're told that after Joseph has been told to take Mary as his wife in spite of her pregnancy, he did not know her, and they did not come together until after the child was born. Does that mean they didn't literally get married until after the birth of Christ?
No, they were legally married, but they didn't consummate the marriage until after the birth of Jesus.
Okay. Let's then look at from Nazareth and this couple, this man, Joseph, there laboring in Nazareth, a citizen, as you said, of Bethlehem, to their journey down to Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. He takes her with him so that they have this arrangement that they are already at least traveling together. What is Bethlehem as a town?
Bethlehem in those days is another little speck on the map. It was not very big at all. The Phillips Brooks has it right in the Carol, a little town of Bethlehem in those days. We conjecture was only 1,000 or 1,500 tops in terms of a little village there in the outskirts of Jerusalem. And it would be about 5 miles southwest of Jerusalem, where it is today. There is an escarpment there over which the central part of the city is located. Church of the Nativity stands over the summit of one of the hills there, and under it there are all kinds of caverns perforating this Bethlehem escarpment. And according to one of the earliest church fathers, Justin Martyr, Jesus was born in a cave or grotto or cavern that was used as a stable. You have to remember again, Todd, the New Testament does not say he was born in a stable. It simply says there was a manger there, a feeding trough for animals. So it's implying a stable, but not one that's built above ground, but one that Mother Nature herself had provided.
Okay. You say that Bethlehem is a very small town.
Not today.
They travel there, and one of the most curious statements, and it's always struck me as curious, Joseph comes from Bethlehem. He's working either temporarily or semi-permanently in Nazareth. But he's a citizen of the place. He's got to have family in Bethlehem. He gets down there with Mary, and it says that the baby has to be born and laid in a manger because there's no room for them in the inn. What are they even looking at hotels for? I mean, he's got family
question.
There, doesn't he?
It's interesting that the same question bothered Ken Bailey, who's a New Testament scholar who lived over there for quite a while. And he points out that the Greek... there was no room for them in the inn. Kataluma is the Greek term. And Luke uses that also for the upper room where the disciples and Jesus celebrated the Last Supper. So his conjecture is that when they got to Bethlehem, they stayed with relatives, of course, fellow members of the house of David, but the guest chamber, and they only had one in the homes in those days, was already occupied, evidently, by other relatives. And so they were put in the garage instead. Now, the garage in those days was the stable underneath the house where the donkey was, the Ford V8 of the time. And so that was the only place where they had shelter. Well, that's one interpretation. I still prefer to go with Justin Martyr's explanation of it as an underground cavern used as a stable, because that is where the Church of the Nativity stands today.
Now, so the picture here is that they're not being shown no hospitality, which, as you mentioned, Ken Bailey makes quite a fine point of the fact that hospitality was the order, literally the order of the day in Palestine, in the ancient world.
True, right.
They may be staying with relatives, just not staying in the living room or sleeping on the couch.
Exactly. And, of course, with other members of the House of David coming back to Bethlehem, you probably have the city somewhat inflated population-wise. And what's interesting is to notice that when the Magi come... 40-plus days later, by that time they're living in a house, not in this cave or stable or whatever else at that point. And that's to be expected. I think the parallel today would be you didn't phone ahead, you're on vacation, late in the afternoon you say, hey, let's get a motel, and what do you see? All these neon signs, no vacancy, no vacancy, no vacancy. What do you see the next morning? Vacancy, vacancy, vacancy. So I think it may have been something like that.
Real quickly, about 1 minute before our break. The manger, it's always depicted as a little wooden feeding trough. Is that what it was, do you think?
Well, it could have been, but mangers, what's interesting is that a lot of stone mangers have been discovered over there. For example, up at Megiddo, where Solomon had so many of his horses, There's stone mangers after stone mangers there discovered archaeologically from 2,500 years ago, and they're still there. There's a little hollowed-out area near the top where they put the straw, but it's the rest of it's stone.
My guest is Dr. Paul Meyer. We're talking about The First Christmas, basing our conversation on a book. Well, it first came out in 1991. It's a new edition out now with color illustrations and photographs, a beautiful layout called The First Christmas. He's also professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Before we leave Bethlehem behind, when we come back from this break, can you go to the very place where Jesus was born? How certain are we that the Church of the Nativity there in Bethlehem is the spot where Jesus was born? Stay with us.
We need to hear from each and every one of you. Please support this worldwide outreach with a year-end tax-deductible donation today.
Next week on Issues Etc., we're going to discuss the history of the King James Bible. Dr. Alistair McGrath of Oxford University in England will be my guest. Where did the King James Bible come from? How has this Bible, published in 1611, influenced modern Christianity? We'll talk about it next week on Issues Etc. with Dr. Alistair McGrath. My guest during this hour, Dr. Paul Meyer, we're talking about the first Christmas. If I go to Bethlehem today, Dr. Meyer, can I be certain if I go to the Church of the Nativity, whether or not I'm looking at the actual spot where Jesus was born?
Well, it's an excellent question, Todd. I think a lot of pilgrims going to the Holy Land want to know exactly, did these events happen here, or is the guide selling us a bill of goods? And whenever I take a group over there, I have kind of a 1 to 10 scale for authenticity. I've been known to stand behind the guide while he's talking to our group, you know, and hold up a 2 or a 3 or something like that. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being absolutely authentic, the Church of the Nativity, believe it or not, is a pretty strong 8, maybe even a 9.
How so?
Well, the reason I say that is this. When you're trying to gauge the authenticity of a site over there, you look for two big hallmarks. One is the site properly deep into the ground? You have to remember the topography has changed. It's 15 feet higher today in Jerusalem and probably Bethlehem as well because of the destructions and the rebuildings across 20 centuries. Jerusalem alone has been destroyed and rebuilt 13 times since Jesus' day. So when you see a site that is above, for instance, the upper room in Jerusalem, it's still an upper room, so I give that a 0 on my scale. It's just impossible for that upper room to have been still an upper room. Today it would be on a street level or below. Now, the grotto, of course, is deep. That's not the only reason, of course, that I would attach authenticity here. What I look for more than anything else is the paper trail. How far back do the records go? How old is the passport? See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the reasons I cannot get excited over the Shroud of Turin like everyone else does, or so many people do. Its passport goes back to the 14th century, which is still 1,400 years after Easter, you see.
Well, how far back does the paper trail and the passport
well,
go on the ground?
Let's begin just 300 years after Christmas, just for openers, 1,700 years back. Let's begin there. Constantine wants to erect the Church of the Nativity and wants to know where Jesus was born. So his engineers consult the Christian bishop of Jerusalem, whose name was Makarios, and he had no trouble identifying the site because it was always in living memory of the Jerusalem church. And he based his thinking also on a testimony 100 years before that. Now we're in the 200s A.D. The writings of Justin, I should say the writings of Origen, the great Eastern theologian who lived in Palestine. And he tells us that whenever he came to Bethlehem, that even the pagans there were willing to tell anyone who would listen where that great Jesus was born, whom the Christians worshipped. So this thing had become something like what the Eiffel Tower is to Paris, you see, the symbolic center of the tourist attraction. And then 100 years before that, we have Justin Martyr, who was born in neighboring Samaria, and who certainly knew that area. And he says that Jesus was born in a well-known cave that was still marked in Bethlehem. Now that's 150 A.D. That's getting pretty close to the first Christmas.
All right, then let's go to that first Christmas. These shepherds who show up. I've always wondered as a little child, how do shepherds out in the field, you know, sitting with their flocks at night, find a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes, even in a town as small as Bethlehem? How do they find him? I mean, they're told to go find it and say, you'll see this sign, a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes, but you got to find the baby wrapped in swaddling clothes first. Do they do a house-to-house search?
That's a good question, Todd. I hadn't really thought of it in that way, so I don't have an immediate answer other than they're listening for a baby's cry, maybe.
Well, it's hard to say.
But no, really, again, you have to remember Bethlehem is so small at that time that it's a little rumor factory, and I'm sure they could immediately question anybody there who was awake at the time. Oh, where's that poor girl who came down from Galilee who wasn't able to find decent housing? And I think the word would pass rather easily as to where the baby could be found.
So a baby being born in Bethlehem, Bethlehem being a small enough town, probably wasn't an everyday occurrence, especially if an outsider comes in and gives birth that night.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about the Magi. Who were they?
Well, we don't know their names. The names Gaspar, Melchior, Caspar, and Balthazar, I should say, are only traditional names that came later on. We don't know if there were three. All we know is there were plurality of them. St. John Chrysostom made quite a caravan of their visit. He thought there were 12, although he may have got that number from the Jesus apostles. It's hard to say. But the Magi as a caste, as a group, were very well known among the Persians in particular, who had taken over control, of course, of Babylonia for centuries after Cyrus the Great. And so they, again, would have been very well known as a caste of university academics. They were specialists in law and medicine and religion and history, astronomy. So they were really, in the absence of universities, they were the walking universities of their time. So they're very well known as a caste, as a group, and for them to have asked for a newborn king in Jerusalem at first strikes one as far-fetched. You know, how could these wise men traipse across a desert after a star and then come perfectly loaded with that wonderful question? You know, these magi who had never been in touch with the parameters of any Jewish prophecies regarding the star. Well, that premise is wrong, I discovered, because I even had doubts about that when I went through my doubt phase as well. But the premise is wrong that they would not have been in touch with any symptoms of prophecy in regarding the star, because I forgot all about Nebuchadnezzar, Babylonian captivity of the Jews. A Jewish colony stayed on in Babylon for the next 400 years after the first Christmas. They didn't all come back under Ezra. And so it would have been bread-and-butter type of information for these magi to have learned all the messianic prophecies in regard to the star.
Now, tell us what this star, to the best of your ability to discern it, what is it?
Two categories of explanation, Todd. I can't tell you which one is right, but the one category says, don't try to find any natural phenomenon behind it. It was God's special sign, a miraculous sign, and therefore don't even look for any natural explanation. The other category says, well, wait a minute. It could have been a natural phenomenon which God used for his own purposes. And I think in their heart of hearts, any Christians would have to say either interpretation would be acceptable theologically. I incline toward the latter. I do think there was an astral event that took place which would have been pretty spectacular. And what was it? It'll be your next question, I guess.
Absolutely.
And, of course, we don't have an absolute answer to that. But as a matter of fact, every Christmas, you notice, anybody who has a friend in the Associated Press usually has a new version of what the Star of Bethlehem might have been like. Oh, they've guessed everything from comets to meteors to a nova and so forth. And I still think the best explanation was given by our Lutheran astronomer in the 1600s, Johannes Kepler. Kepler was one of the great scientists of all time. He's really the father of the heliocentric system, not Copernicus. And he saw something in the skies overhead that just about blew his mind, and that was the triple conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. Now, let me explain. He calculated correctly that this conjunction happens only once every 800 years. It happened at the first Christmas, happened in 800, happened in 1600 when Kepler saw it, will not come again till 2400. We'll never see it. But just imagine, let's say, St. Louis area, go west to the rural Missouri some night, and a beautiful summer night when they're away from the city lights. Check the Milky Way overhead, and you're going to see one or two very bright stars. And those aren't stars at all. They are planets. They're either Jupiter or Saturn or Venus, sometimes Mars, but those are the three big ones. Now imagine those super bright stars, as it were, parked next to each other, less than one moon diameter apart. And many of the ancients had bad eyesight. It would look like a single superstar as far as they're concerned. That would have been a spectacular sight, I think, indeed. And now, the astrology behind that is just wild. Let me hasten to tell you, Todd, and your listeners, I do not believe in astrology. I hope they don't either. But the Magi did. And never underestimate God's use of whatever he wants in order to convey his great message. And according to the ancient astrology, this would have been very meaningful because Jupiter, being the largest planet, is the king's planet. And Saturn, the ring planet, even the Book of Amos says, is the shield or defender of Palestine. So now Jupiter approaches Saturn. What does this mean? A king is approaching Palestine. Possibly this is a good explanation.
So here are these astrologers, these ancient university types, looking up at the sky. They see the king's planet approaching the planet that they associate with Palestine, and they say, well, this is all quite obvious. So they put it together with the knowledge they might have had of Old Testament prophecy by way of their studies, and they say, let's go see him who is born, king of the Jews.
That scenario is not impossible. I really think that could have happened. Mm-hmm.
When did they come?
Okay, this is a fascinatingly disputed question. There are so many Christians who assume that Jesus was 2 years old when they arrived, because Herod killed all the babies 2 years old and under, you recall. Okay, the Bible does not say that he was 2 years old. Herod determined that he's going to have a safe margin here of killing all babies 2 years old and under, quote, according to when the star appeared as he gathered from the Magi. And it is easily possible that this astral phenomenon could have begun before Jesus was born. I personally think not that much time elapsed between the birth of Jesus and the arrival of the Magi. We know there has to be at least 40 days. Why? Because in day 40, they bring Jesus to Jerusalem to present him at the temple, as you recall. And they certainly would not have made that trip if there were an all-points bulletin out for baby Jesus.
Real quick, before we go to this break, were the Magi at the manger scene? Were they there the night when the shepherds arrived?
Well, they couldn't possibly have been. No, it was only the shepherds. It's our creches that bunched them all together. But that's all right. Leave the Magi under the tree. It's okay.
My guest is Dr. Paul Meyer. We're talking about the first Christmas. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. When we come back, we're going to talk about Herod and the slaughter of the innocents in Bethlehem. Folks, you can read several articles by our guest, Dr. Paul Meyer, on the historicity of Jesus Christ, including a chapter from his book, The First Christmas, on our website. The website address is issuesetc.org. And under that What's New section, you'll find these resources, including that article, The Historicity of Jesus Christ, articles on that, and a chapter from The First Christmas. Our website address, again, issuesetc.org. Without going into too much detail about Herod himself, a despicable character by anyone's estimation, let's get straight to the story where Herod enters the picture with the Magi and his decision to slaughter the innocents in Bethlehem. What kind of a What was the scope of this edict from the king of Israel to kill the babies in a small town south of Jerusalem?
Well, it's a terrible thing, of course, and there are some radical revisionist biblical critics who say it never happened. It's amazing how often you hear that. In regard to the nativity account, the two most doubted aspects are the virgin birth, I find, among students around here, and the other would be Herod was bad, but he wasn't that bad. He couldn't have killed those babies. And many critics simply say Matthew is only trying to point about a tremendous contrast between the light of Christmas and the darkness of a terrible king, the contrast argument. They've pointed out that Herod wouldn't have done this kind of thing. Well, fortunately, we have Flavius Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, who gives us a whole court history on Herod. You talk about data, Josephus gives us about 1,000 times as much data on Herod the Great as we get in Matthew's Gospel. So what you do is you read through Josephus and you try to get a character portrait of Herod in his old age, and then you check Matthew out and you find that this is an identical fingerprint. It's just an identical FBI fingerprint. It's the same person. There's no question about it.
How many babies were killed in Bethlehem under this edict?
Well, you see, this is what so many of the critics say: hundreds of Jewish boy babies were murdered, and therefore that would have come to Josephus' attention. And it's true that Josephus doesn't mention that. But the premise is wrong. There's no way there would have been hundreds of Jewish boy babies available for slaughter, 2 years old and under. I did an actuarial study of Bethlehem at the time, and there probably would have been no more than 20 babies tops, 2 years old and under, half of them the wrong sex. And so in an era of high infant mortality anyway, I'm not sure that this would even have come to Josephus's notice.
So maybe a dozen at
the top? Yeah, a dozen tops, yeah, 10 or 12. And by the way, Herod killed 35% of that number in his own family. He executed 3 of his own sons on suspicion of treason. He executed his favorite wife, the beautiful Maccabean Princess Mariamne, killed his mother-in-law, killed his uncle, several cousins. A real family man Herod was.
Now
he invited the high priest down to Jericho for a swim. They played a very rough game of water polo. They drowned him. So it's the kind of person who could have done that, you bet.
The high priest?
The high priest, yeah, was drowned.
Man, I'd love to hear that story. We just don't have the time to hear the rest of it. The slaughter of the innocents, or at least the edict from Herod, occasions the flight to Egypt. What was this flight like? How long did they stay in Egypt, the Holy Family?
Well, some scholars suggest they could have gone no further than Gaza because Gaza was controlled by Egypt, but I doubt that. That would have been too close. Herod certainly was born in neighboring Ashkelon. It would have been a dangerous place to be. I think they went on to Alexandria. The reason I say that is because more Jews were living in Alexandria at the time than even the city of Jerusalem. So they would have had no trouble finding accommodations with fellow relatives in the house of David there. Cairo is out because Cairo won't be invented for 12 centuries yet.
They're really fleeing not just Herod's jurisdiction, but his influence too, aren't they? I mean, they're afraid to be anywhere where Herod might be able to have any kind of influence.
Certainly, and I think that's why the Gaza hypothesis doesn't hold water.
How long were they in Egypt?
How long were they in Egypt? Probably not too long, because remember again, Jesus is born toward the end of 5 B.C., and Herod dies in April of 4 B.C. So if Jesus were born in October, November, December of 5 B.C., we had about a month or two, I think, to spend in the flight to Egypt. Well, first of all, 40 days is going to have to elapse before they even take the flight. So I really don't think they were there too long because Herod dies and then they return.
When they return, Joseph appears to want to go back to Bethlehem. But then
they'd almost have to go back to Bethlehem in terms of the routing they would take. I think he probably checked things out there to see if they should stay there, but then he heard that Archelaus, Herod's son, was in charge, and he was no winner either. And so they decided to go back to Nazareth.
This leads us to the title that Jesus bears, by and large, even to his death. The inscription over his head reads, Jesus of Nazareth. At the very beginning of his ministry, there's one of his disciples who asks of Jesus, what good can come out of Nazareth? Tell us about what these scriptural and secular sources give us of Jesus of Nazareth, our Savior?
Well, again, he's called Jesus of Nazareth because, after all, he spent most of his infancy and youth and early adulthood and beginning ministry in Nazareth. It's important to mention that because you can't believe the number of critics, Todd, who are suggesting that Jesus was not born in Bethlehem, but he was born in Nazareth. And to prove it, they'll go back to the title in Jesus' cross, and they say, Jesus of Nazareth, it says, therefore he was born in Nazareth. And I think it's ridiculous thinking. Here he's born in Bethlehem, and he spends 50 days there approximately, and that's all. Doesn't really return except momentarily in the arms of his mother there on the way back to Nazareth. And he should be called Jesus of Bethlehem if he were born there, I think is ridiculous thinking. There's no evidence whatever that he was born in Nazareth rather than Bethlehem.
But this puts Jesus up in Galilee, where his ministry begins, where he gathers all of his disciples, where the majority of his teaching takes place. And I think we often think about Jesus always traipsing around the streets of Jerusalem rather than as the Gospels really present it. He's a man of Galilee and the Decapolis for the most part, isn't he?
Yes, he certainly is. The trips down to Judea were only exceptional, sometimes in connection with the high festivals that took place, but most of his ministry indeed, and all the great Gospel accounts are associated very often with seascape events. The Sea of Galilee is very important, and the ships there and so forth. And what's interesting is that a ship that Jesus could have used, I'm not saying he did, but a sunken hull of a boat, very much like what Jesus would have used, was found in 1986 and has since been excavated and impregnated with rosins of all kinds so it doesn't decay. And it's 25 feet long with a 7-foot beam in back. And it tells us quite a bit, you know, about how Jesus could sleep through a storm, would be under the decking in the rear, and how he was asleep on the pillow, St. Mark's Gospel says. Instead of a pillow, a cushion should have been, but it says the, implying it's part of the boat's rigging. And we know what that is. Now it's a ballast sack that was used to keep the hull correctly positioned in the face of a wind when you don't have a keel in the boat. You know, interesting, fascinating details like this that help fine-tune the gospel accounts.
How important is it that Christians base their faith on the facts and not on romanticized or fantasized versions or embellishments of the Gospels?
Well, this, Todd, is what sets the Christian faith apart from all other world religions except for our parent Judaism. Judaism and Christianity are the only two religious faiths ever developed on this planet that are totally rooted in history. I'm not trying to say that the other world religious systems don't have historical founders. In Islam, of course, there's certainly Muhammad and so on. But we're talking about the holy books. And in the Quran, you don't find this integration with the political, economic, social life of the times. It's rather a book of rules and regulations, when to give alms for the love of Allah, when to face Mecca, when to pray. But here you have historical bridges that can be built, which is, I think, the long suit of Judeo-Christianity. I feel like Christians really don't realize how powerfully credible our faith is on the historical basis.
Dr. Paul Meyer, thank you very much for your time, for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Been great being with you, Todd.
Dr. Paul Meyer on the First Christmas, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and author of several books, including the newest edition of his 1991 book called The First Christmas. We've talked a lot about the what of Christmas. The why and the wherefore of Christmas, folks, let's never forget this. Jesus Christ came in history, born of a woman, born under the law. Jesus Christ, our Savior, did not appear as a fantasy or as a cardboard cutout or some sort of heroic figure of the ancient past in mist and fantasy. A real baby in real historical circumstances, in a real manger, in the arms of a real woman, under the tutelage of a real stepfather. It's a real cross, folks. It's a real death he died for you and for me, for sinners, and he really has risen again. I'm Todd Wilkin, hoping you have a Christ-centered Christmas.
If you appreciate this Issues Etc. classic and other shows throughout the year, please consider making a year-end tax-deductible donation today. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org You can also make a financial contribution by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind at the end of the year.